So I'm going to start with a very classic old question, which is, in general, how many lines in three space intersect four given lines? It's a very old problem question, and one of the early answers is given by Schubert. And I'm going to try to draw this on the board, but it's going to be a terrible picture. I have to do it. So what you do is you take two of the lines. His method is you take two of the lines, you make them intersect. You take two of the other lines, and you make them intersect. And then if you're capable of holding all four lines, you hold them generically and you just count. In this case, it's pretty easy to see the line between these two x's intersects all four given lines, and there's a plane of intersection, and that intersects all four lines. So the answer is 2. And there's some argument, why is this always the right answer? I'm not going to try to go into that in great detail, but the point is that these whole questions actually preceded the whole idea of homology and cohomology. But trying to make this rigorous was a really big impetus for a fair amount of modern mathematics. And now we can say this quite differently. So we would now ask the same question very differently, more generally. So we're going to let M equal G mod P, where here G is a semi-simple algebraic group, and P is parabolic subgroup. And if you're not very happy with that, that's fine. It won't matter too much. You can just think of the Grassmannian of two planes in C4, or flag manifolds. But in this case up here, this is the Grassmannian of two planes in C4. And you can let X alpha contain an M be a Schubert variety. And the example we had before, we're considering, so lines in three spaces, basically planes in four space. So this is just V in the Grassmannian, which intersect a given plane in more than one point. It's the same thing as the lines intersecting. And your question is, what's the intersection? This is the basic question behind Schubert calculus, trying to find these. And your ideal answer is counting. Up there, we just counted, right? Just look at something counted. That's really what we want our answer to be, a count. So, or another way of looking at counting is the sum of positive integers. And this whole subject of Schubert calculus is very important, and I will tell you almost nothing about it. Because what I'm really interested in is generalizing this, so focusing on efforts to generalize this to a much broader setting, which was inspired in part by Victor Guillemin. Well, so that's what I'm talking about today. Okay. Well, in large part. Okay, so I'm going to write over here my standard assumptions, which are going to change at some point. So I'll try to keep this board unwritten on. So we start with a compact symplectic manifold. I don't think it needs to be connected, but if you're troubled by that, you can make it so. And we're going to have a torus which acts on M omega And we're going to assume that the action is Hamiltonian. We're going to fix C in T generic. And I'm always going to assume that the fixed point set is discrete. These are the basic ingredients that go into this. You can actually, you can deal without this if you want, but I'm not going to. And our example, which I have hardly left enough room for, is going to be the complete flag on C3. So this, of course, is an example of one of these Gmod P. And again, this is the case you should think about if you don't want to think about it more generally. And I'm going to draw the moment map. And I'm going to pick C. Pick a direction. And our goal of the whole program, which of course I won't accomplish in complete generality today, is find a natural basis x alpha. Ah, I left out one important thing for the homology and the compute the intersection. So the one important thing I believe I have in my notes but forgot to write down is that x alpha gives a basis. So if you look at one of these and take it all the Schubert varieties, you get a natural basis for the homology. So in other words, we're trying to, the ideal goal again, the absurd ideal goal would be to find answers as nice as the answers that they can find for Schubert calculus. I say it's an absurd ideal goal is because, as you'll see, I mean, sometimes, for instance, if the answer is not positive, you can't really hope to have a positive formula for it, right? That's going to plague us in many situations. But at least as much as one can hope to. And that's what I'll be talking about today, is what we can say about. Are there any questions about? Yep.
You're not going to assume that M has a G action.
No. Just a T action. So, it turns out that rather than answering this question, we're going to answer a question which looks a little bit harder, but it's going to turn out to be easier. Which is we're going to go from homology to equivariant cohomology. So, whenever you work with Hamiltonian actions, you find the equivariant cohomology is almost always an easier thing to work with. Cohomology. So, for those of you who are not familiar with this, I could just say Rayer defined it, and therefore everyone's responsible for it, but I won't do that. But I'll give you a very brief introduction. What is the equivariant cohomology of a manifold? So you simply take the ordinary cohomology of, well, what you do is you take M, and you take the product of that with N copies of S infinity. Remember, our torus is F1 to the N. And you divide out by the torus action. That's simply what this is. And the important things to remember about this are, well, first of all, it is a cohomology theory, so things you think ought to be true are true. But we'll really need three important facts. So the first is what is the equivariant cohomology of a point? Well, if we have no M, And we're just defining S infinity, n copies of S infinity by n copies of S1. We get n copies of CP infinity. This is just a polynomial ring in n variables. So equivariant cohomology of a point is highly non-trivial. It's completely different from ordinary cohomology. And I usually like to be, well, this more naturally, if you drop your basis. It's just polynomials in T star. That's usually the way it'll appear. And the other two important facts, that if you take the equivariant cohomology of your manifold, like I say, it behaves well, like you think it should. So there's a restriction map to the equivariant cohomology of fixed points. And this map is an injection. And why this matters is it tells you if you want to understand equivariant cohomology, you only need to understand its restrictions of the fixed point set. So the fixed points tell you everything you need to know. That's the take-home message of this. Again, very much unlike ordinary cohomology. And the other thing is you see, if you take any orbit of T, M sits naturally inside this space. So there's also a natural restriction map to ordinary cohomology. And this map is surjective. It's often referred to as equivariant formality. But again, if you're not used to this, what you need to remember about this is that equivariant cohomology tells you everything you need to know about ordinary cohomology also. So if any of these questions that you want to ask about cohomology or characteristic classes, again, you just need to look at the equivariant cohomology procedure at the fixed points. And why is this the right thing to look at? Well, the basic reason is because what we're going to look at is the Xeth component of the Morse function, the moment map. And the claim is this is a Morse function. And it's a very special kind of Morse function. The critical set is just a fixed set. And this is going to be underlying everything that we do. And I need some more notation. For all p, we're going to get lambda of p be 1 half the index of p. This is for all fixed points p, or equivalently all critical points p. And the index is always going to be even, so this makes sense. And again, that is because the critical set's the fixed set. And then we're also going to get big lambda of p is going to be the equivariant Euler class of the negative normal bundle. So again, if you're not familiar with, this is just a product of the weights. So each weight lies in T star. So its product, the product of all the weights, is a polynomial in T star. And because the fixed is critical, this is a non-zero polynomial. It's the weights in the negative normal bundle. I prefer to choose my convention. So the weights in the negative normal bundle are the positive weights. But I was trying not to actually say that lest it drive everyone batty. that is correct. Just because I'm going to be talking about positivity, and otherwise the signs get too much. Okay, great. So given that, what are we going to look at? I can now talk about the basic objects. So, which is a canonical class So what is a canonical class? Well, it's an element in the aquivariant cohomology whose index is the index of P, whose degree, I'm sorry, is the index of P, with two properties. The alpha P restricted to P is the product of the weights in the negative normal bundle. And the alpha P restricted to Q is equal to zero for all fixed points Q not equal to P, such that lambda Q is less than or equal to lambda P. So the restriction will not be zero in general on points of higher index, but it will be equal to zero on points of lower or equal index. So that's the definition of a canonical class. So if you haven't seen these before, how do you think of these? What am I talking about? Possibly the definition seems a little bit abstract. And the important thing is that if M is a generalized slag manifold, so if M is equal to G mod P, we have three facts. So first of all, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the fixed points and the Schubert varieties. And the Schubert varieties is just the stable manifold of the fixed points. And finally, that alpha P is the equivariant Poincaré dual. Of XP. So these are cohomology, these are equivariant cohomology classes, which are sort of equivariant extensions of the standard Poincaré dual. And you want to always think of these classes as being the equivariant Poincaré duals of stable manifolds. But I'm not going to prove that makes sense. But that is what you want to think of them as. And you won't go wrong. Are there any questions?
Stable manifold for some
gradient. Yes, that's right. That's right. So you have the Morse function psi, and you pick a metric. So in this case, you take the Kähler metric. Like I said, that's one of the reasons why I say morally, because one has issues if one wants to make it. But yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so what are the properties of these alpha P? Well, what properties do we want? Well, we want them to be natural. And in fact, the alpha P is unique. So that's pretty easy to check, that there can only be one of them. For each P, obviously. Another thing we wanted is for them to form a basis. And they do. So if you take the set of all alpha P, this is a basis for the equivariant cohomology of M. As a module over the equivariant cohomology of a point. Which means that the image in ordinary cohomology is a basis in the standard sense. This is the thing you would reasonably, this is the sensible thing to hope for. So that's almost all the properties that we wanted, but there's sort of one more, which we actually want them to exist. So, do the alpha P's exist? So clearly I already said they do exist in our case of the generalized slags. And the answer to this is yes, if P T is a circle. But no, in general. It's pretty easy to construct examples where they don't exist. And in fact, if I'm being completely honest, I should say, yeah, fish. If T is a circle. Meaning that they always exist rationally. But again, since what I'm going to be talking about is integral formulas, it's going to be hard to get if my answer is not integer. These are not necessarily integer classes, T equals S1. And I will say that a lot of what I'm talking about today, in fact, I think most of what I'm talking about today is true whenever you have these canonical classes. But I wanted to focus on one particular case, and doing two different cases started making the notation unbearable. And so to simplify notation, I'm just going to do one case, but just remember that a lot of what I'm saying will work in this more general case of whenever they exist. Okay, are there any questions so far? Okay. So, at this point, what's our goal? So I said that our goal was to compute these intersections, and then I said that I would transform this to another different goal, which was actually easier. And the goal prime is to compute alpha p, which is just a q, for all p and q. That's what I'll be talking about today. Now, because of my the general nonsense I talked about in terms of the injectivity and the surjectivity of those two maps, if you can compute alpha p of 60 to q, then you can compute these intersections. However, I have to be honest, is that when you make that translation, you lose positivity. So I will not be giving a completely general formula for positivity for all intersections and all flag manifolds. But you don't get a formula for that. That would be very nice. And that's one of the very important open problems in Schubert calculus. So it would be great to do, and if we can think of a way to do that, well, anyway, we will try. But I'm not doing that today. Okay. I can put this in. This is q of q x alpha is given x q 1 dot x q k gives that computation. So, in the important example of M equals G mod P, Sarah Billy gives a formula for this thing we want. And this formula has all the properties that you'd want. It's integral, and it's positive. And since I'm an equivariant cohomology, I have to say a little bit about that. These are polynomials, so it still makes sense to talk about integral polynomials. It's no problem. And positivity is I picked a direction in xi, so I can say something's positive if it's pairing with xi is positive. So those still both make sense. And so what we'd really like, her formula is really beautiful. What we'd really like to do is to explain this formula geometrically. And sort of explain it geometrically means prove a theorem, which is ideally as nice on ideally a huge class of symplectic manifolds, and understand exactly what geometry is forcing each property. If it's not true in general, understand what geometrically does it mean that these things are true. That's what we'd love to do. I feel like hopefully if we have a number of answers, we also still have quite a few questions. So, like I said today, in order to simplify notation, I'm going to be focusing on one case, one particular case, and that's the case of GKM manifolds. So I better tell you now, what is a GKM manifold? And it's very simple. So remember, I'm already in my basic assumptions. I don't need to remake my basic assumptions. And M is GKM if the dimension of the fixed point set fixed by 8 is less than or equal to 2 for all subtori of codimension 1. So this will have a number of components, and this I mean by this every component has dimension at most 2. Okay, so this is what it means to be GKM. So I'm going to add M is GKM. It's my basic assumption. From now on, I'll be talking about that. And in this case, you can define a labeled oriented graph. So the vertices is just the fixed set. So it's very simple, the vertices of your graph. And then we're going to say that two vertices are an edge if two things hold. Well, first of all, we want that both of them are in the same connected component of M sub H for some H contained in T of codimension 1. So basically, if you look at any H, you're going to get a bunch of points. You just don't ignore those. A bunch of spheres. And the spheres are going to have two vertices, two fixed points. You put an edge between them. But I want to orient my graph. So I'm going to insist that psi of q is greater than psi of t. Just to make my life easy. I only have an edge one way, not the other way. All my edges point up. And then I also need one more piece of information. Is associated to each edge, I need a weight. Eta pq is a weight, and this is equal to the weight at, it's the weight of, sorry, the weight of pq. Q, Z. So you look in this component, they're both in the same component, Z. You look at the weight at Q. And that's just the weight of the edge, basically. But again, and notice I've chosen my orientation according to my convention so that this is positive. Like I said, I'm just keeping everything positive. And make it easier to check what's positive and what's not. And it's a fact that if you know G, you know the cohomology. I won't bother to give the formula, but it's very straightforward. So let's just look at an example. What I've drawn here is actually the GKM graph for the flag manifold. So I just said the flag manifold naturally has two torus acting on it. That's what I've drawn this for. And that action is GKM. And here is the graph. It's got 6 vertices and however many edges. 12 edges. No, 9 edges. Sorry, can't count. Does that make sense?
In the middle.
No, that's right. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah, these just happen to cross it there, but this is not a vertex. You can think of this as under or over crossing each other, if you like. Okay. And these are all oriented so that the questions about this? So we need one more piece of information, which we say, psi, let me not do this here because I'm going to want to show you on that picture. We need one more condition, which is we say psi is increasing if lambda q is greater than lambda p for all pq in E. So for every edge, as you go up the edge, your index increases. Yeah? I do not need anything for uniqueness. I need this condition for existence. Yeah, no, uniqueness sort of is always true with absolutely no condition. If you have one, then you have to be unique. So let's look at this case. Let's draw lambda. It's the number of edges pointing down. So here there's, well, hanging down. Here there's no edges. Here there's one edge. Here there's one edge also. Here there's two edges, here there's two edges, and here's the three edges. And so we can see that that it's increasing. Lambda is increasing on any edge. This is a condition. It's not always true, but it's true in a lot of important examples, including, I should point out, most importantly, all the generalized flag manifolds. This is condition true for. And under this condition, we have the alpha p exists. So, as long as we're here, our problem is completely well posed. What is alpha p which is equal to q? So, like I said, from now on, we're also going to assume that it's increasing. General. This is a general framework in which we can do everything. Like I said, you can do a lot of stuff as long as they exist. But then I need a whole new set of notations. Okay. And because we have a graph, we can talk about paths in the graph. So my notation I will use is gamma pq. This is paths from p to q. What is a path? Well, I'm just going to write an r, which is going to be a k-tuple for any k, with the following properties. You're going to need that R1 is equal to P. The first one is P, the last one is Q, and that each adjacent pair is an edge. So if we look at this example here, we see how many paths are there from the minimum to the maximum. Well, there's one, two, three, four, five paths. And the theorem which really got this started is hope this is possible is Zeta, Gilliman, and Guerra. And alpha p, this is just a q, is equal to the sum over all paths from p to q of some contribution of the path, which I'm not going to explain to you. I think it's fair to say that it's not integral or positive, but
hellishly messy.
And
there are billions of that.
And the question that, I mean, really, I got started on this by Victor asking me, so what can you say about F1? You know, great, we have a formula for GKM spaces. If you know GKM spaces, then F1 actions you're sort of done in some sense. And so that was got me motivated on that. And like I said, that is a case Rebecca and I have worked on, but what I'm going to talk about today is more what we've done implies to the GKM case. Where also it's somewhat different than I sort of initially thought that I would generalize their formula, right? That you'd have we have a formula that worked in general, and if you specialize with GKM, it would be their case.
But then you hit on this great idea of maybe improving the formula.
So, and so you notice in their case, there's five contributions. So what I'll be calculating today is one. My favorite thing to calculate, but it's actually a very useful thing to calculate, because if you can't calculate one, generally you're not in good shape. So if you look at this this definition of alpha p, where I take the minimum, I want a class whose restriction to the minimum is one, because there are no weights pointing down, so the product of nothing is just one. And the only class restriction to the minimum is one is the class one. And the restriction of one to any point is one. So what I'm going to be computing is the restriction of the minimum to the maximum. That one. In this case, we get that one as the sum of five terms. Okay, so. And the goal is to see whether we can get one as one. And if we do, we will consider it somewhat of a victory. Okay. So one, okay, so they give a formula in general, and I'm not going to give their formula in general, but I will give their formula in one particular case, which is actually, it's much, much easier to compute it in this particular case than in general, as well as the formula being easier. Once you read their paper, it's sort of, you pull out this lemma, it's not hard. The important special case, so you can ask this in general, but what if lambda q is just one, the index of lambda q is just one more than the index of p? The important case. And then there exists an integer with the property that if you take theta pq and times it by the weight and the negative normal bundle at q, and divide it by the weight from p to q. So if you look at the picture locally, one of the negative weights at q is always going to be the weight from p to q. So it makes this division make sense. And this is equal to lambda p mod eta pq. So there's a fact, which is not too hard to show, that there exists, it's not totally obvious, but it's not hard either, there exists such a theta. And moreover, alpha p, which is to q, is equal to theta pq lambda q divided by eta pq. So that's the fact, that's their theorem, if you like, in case they give it by one. But like I said, you don't need to understand the whole paper to get this. This case is just one little paragraph, I would say. I mean, it's not quite written out separately, but it's. And the example is if you're in G mod P, theta PQ is just always equal to one. So that makes your life nice. But in any case, it's always an integer. Questions? Okay. So, now I'm going to talk about some of my work with Rebecca. And for what we do, we need to look at a slightly different space of paths. So, which I'm going to call gamma hat PQ. And this is the space of all paths from P to Q, such that each time my index, remember the index is always going up, but here I'm only going to allow the index to go up by one. For all time. So, how is this going to work? I claim this reduces the number of paths. It's not so obvious. In this case, it actually reduces it sometimes by quite a lot. In this case, it's fairly simple. You notice almost all the edges go up one, except this one, which goes up by three. So we're going to kind of cancel it out or whatever. I mean, it's still in the DKM graph, but we're not going to allow those paths. So now you see that we have four paths left. From the minimum to the maximum. And we get the following formula, which I'm going to call, this is a theorem to Rebecca and myself. So I'll call formula star, when I need it later. Alpha P restricted to Q is equal to the sum over all paths in gamma hat. So we're not, these are just the smaller set of paths. The product of R equals, oh, sorry, I forgot. We're always going to have lambda Q, that's just sort of always there. And then the product, R equals 1 to K minus 1, this theta term divided by, it's a little bit complicated, by the weight of this edge, oops, this should really be I plus 1. Sorry, got my of ri plus 1 times theta ri plus 1 minus theta ri divided by theta of q minus theta of ri. Okay, well, this formula is a little bit complicated, so let me try to unpack some of the things about it for you. What's this? Yes, I equals one, thank you. And I'm sorry, what was your question? Yes, the moment map, not the Morse function. Okay, so, like I said, I pointed out the one salient feature, which is there are now over fewer paths. So here's another feature. Remember that this is a product of positive weights, the way I chose it. So this is positive. And this was always chosen to be a positive weight, the way I did. So this is positive. On the other hand, the way I define my graph, every edge is increasing. So this is positive, and this is positive. So it's almost positive. What might be negative is this expression. So it's positive if theta PQ is greater than 0 for all P and Q. Not just that, maybe I should say, well, it's got to be for all P and Q, not just this particular one that you're doing. And so the one important thing to note here is if this is negative, it really means that sometimes these restrictions are negative. So if you're in a case where the restrictions are all positive, then every term in your formula is positive. So that's, I think, as good as you could hope for in terms of positivity, right? I mean, okay? And the other thing is, how about integrality? Okay, that's not going to be so good, but let's check it anyway. First of all, we're having four things adding up to one, which are all positive. So the chance of them being integral is small. But let's see what happens. So I just said this is an integer. Right? Now, what about this? This is the moment image at ri plus 1 and ri, and this is the weight connecting ri and ri plus 1. So if our symplectic form is integral, which it might as well have been, this is also integral. Okay? What's troubling is this darn thing at the bottom here. Now, well, it turns out, this may not seem so impressive. It's integral if m is equal to pn. Okay, so I admit that's kind of a special case, but anyway, that's a case of force. Otherwise, in general, it's not going to be integral. You can do the calculations. That's exactly when all of them are integral. Okay, so fine. So we definitely have not achieved our original goal, but we've achieved part of it. So I want to get to the last page. So I'll skip this page. I'll just tell you that say that PQ is not necessarily equal to 1, and it's not necessarily positive. You can find examples where it's negative, and where the restrictions are negative. Okay, so not erase this. So this is where we were, and we kind of just didn't see, maybe I shouldn't see for Rebecca, but I didn't really see any hope of making this integral. And then there was a theorem by Catlin-Zara, which I'm sort of going to not give incredible detail what states. But basically it says if you take formula star and you add limits, you can tell me if this is a grotesque interpretation of your paper, and you add limits, you can use this to get Sarabelli's formula. So you can manipulate this in some way and get something integral, even though it's totally not integral itself. And so Sylvia Sabatini and I were talking about this, and we tried to understand, again, what's happening geometrically, because that's sort of our goal. And we get the following theorem, which initially, you may think this theorem already is a little bit bad. Unfortunately, our theorem initially looks exactly like this theorem, but worse. So you do something a little bit weird, is that for every fixed point, you choose some, and they're going to be, in general, different at all the fixed points. Omega r plus phi r, equivariantly closed to form. So, and this is going to be a closed two form. This is going to be any function such that, I forget my convention, but I c omega is negative d phi, hopefully. anyway, we don't know if this is symplectic, and it won't be in the interesting examples. And we don't necessarily say they'll be the same, and they won't be any interesting examples. That's the important thing. And what we're going to get is almost exactly the same formula. So it's the sum over R in gamma PQ hat of lambda Q, the product I equals 1 to K minus 1, V sub RI, Ri plus 1, eta sub Ri, Ri plus 1. So now it'll look exactly the same. So far I'm just writing the exact same formula. Weird spacing. But now here, this is the moment map to the Ri's term. So I'm allowing the pre-symplectic form to be different at every vertex. I do have one condition, which is I don't want to divide by zero. Like, this isn't going to make sense if I'm dividing by zero. So, but that's the only condition I need, is it makes sense, as long as theta Ri sub Q is not equal to theta Ri of Ri for all Ri. So like I said, it's exactly the same formula, but now I'm allowing it to vary. Okay, so great. So why isn't this just, why is this interesting, right? I mean, I don't really love subscripts. So why do I care? And the reason I care is I can now, in many interesting examples, I can now get rid of more paths. And we're going to actually see that for that example, we're going to calculate one as one, which was our goal. Well, it will be one. So, when is it that this theorem gives you more power? Well, if you think about it, if you just multiply your symplectic form by something, it doesn't change anything at all, because you're just going to divide and multiply by the same thing. So that's totally not interesting. However, when it's interesting is if you have at least a two-dimensional family of forms. That's when it gives you some power. And when it gives you the most power is when you have a bundle. So let's assume that we're in that case. So we're going to assume our symplectic manifold, all these are GKM spaces, is a bundle and it's an equivariant map of another GKM space, whose fiber is also a GKM space. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to try, when I have some symplectic form on the base, right, so some symplectic form and moment map, and I'm going to let CD be the pullback of the moment map from the base. So this moment map, if you have anything in the same fiber, they're going to give you the same value there. Right? So what's going to happen is if they're in the same fiber, this guy is going to vanish, which means that you can throw out those paths. Of course, you have to be careful not to make this vanish. So if, because we need these to be different, so if we're in the same fiber, if all I is in the same fiber as Q, we can't pick. We have to pick the generic symplectic form. We can't take the pullback of the form from the base. As long as we're in a different fiber, we can take the pullback from the base. And this is going to drastically reduce the number of paths we have to consider. That's the idea. So what does this give us in this example? The key thing, the formula is still kind of messy. The important thing to remember is the number of paths that we have to consider. And these are just going to be the paths. So now this is gamma tilde PQ. And these are the paths in gamma hat PQ, so I'm still insisting I'm only going up by one, such that pi of ri is not equal to pi I plus 1 unless pi of ri equals pi of q. This is true for all I. So what this tells me is that I'm never allowed to take a step which is purely in the fiber until I'm forced to, until I get stuck in the same fiber I want to end up in. And let's look at this picture. Okay. So there is a map. In this case, there's a map from the complete flag on C3 to P3. Let me do to this one. And I ask which edges are in the fiber of this map. Well, this edge gets squished, and this edge gets squished, and this edge gets squished. However, this is the slightly tricky part, is in this edge, once I'm at this point, I'm in the same fiber as Q, and Q is the point I'm restricting to, the maximum. So I can't get rid of this edge. But what I'm going to do is I'm getting rid of, this is a bad choice of colors. I'm getting rid of those two edges. Those are no longer allowed in my paths. So now how many paths do I have from the minimum to the maximum? Well, I start here. I'm only allowed to go here. I'm only allowed to go here. I'm only allowed to go here. So I just have one path. So that's good. Now you notice that here I have two paths. That's actually okay. I mean, I'm not always going to get one path. Even in Sarah Billy's formula, you don't always get one path. Because if you're getting one, there's only one way to get it, which is this one path. But if you're getting, say, three, you can get it as a one plus a two or whatever. There's plenty of ways. So that doesn't disturb me too much. Okay? So in this case, this only consists of one path. And the point is that our formula is now a sum over this one path. I'm going to write out the formula. It's not that important to focus on the details of it, except for that what it's the sum over. And then it's still just as positive as it was before, and just as, well, it's now more integral. 1 for eta ri plus 1. Unfortunately, it's more evil now. The product, that was the product. Now we have the product of all the ones which are not in the same fiber. Where we use the base one. And then we have the product of all the ones which are in the same fiber as Q, where we use the standard symplectic form. So. Okay, so great. So in this example, this gave us integer classes, but that was an awful special example. What can you say in general? And in general, it's still often not integral. However, it is integral in one special case, which is it's integral if both f and b are projective spaces. Okay, well that's only somewhat more general, but now this whole procedure is really inductive. So you can say, okay, well, it'll also be integral if your fiber, if you have a vibration over a projective space whose fiber is itself a vibration over a projective space with fiber projective space. And you can go on and on and on. I mean, think of a nice way to write the general diagram, but in this case, you always get integral terms. So, for example, this explains why you get integral terms for the flag manifold, because this has this format. So it's a natural projection of a PN, and its fiber is itself a flag manifold. Now, as is, this does not yet give integral terms for all the Lie groups. However, so this is basically done, though admittedly not completely written up. What we're still working on, but we sort of believe we can do, is by grouping together terms, get integral formula for all the non-exceptional Lie groups. And we have not yet dealt with the exceptional Lie groups. Some of them are not so obvious, but they're finite, so maybe, I don't know. Anyway, we haven't thought about that carefully enough for me to really come up one way or the other. I'm out of time.
Well, we'll have to get questions for later.